It's so nice to see everybody. And back to our Monday morning learning. We've been knee deep as we started last week, a very important topic and a very important sugya, the topic of L'samod al damrei echa, to what extent we go to save lives. And of course, how significant this is in the current culture and climate for which we find ourselves, the application of what it is we have to do to be vigilant, to be responsible ourselves, what we have to do to be responsible as it relates to encouraging, cajoling other people as well. So just a very, very brief, quick overview. And I know that the Hebrew sources are before you, and for everyone's comfort, you should know I'm going to translate everything, so we should know everything that we're talking about here together. So, to what extent do we go to save people's lives? The concept of the bystander effect, and to take a proactive measure to save a life, just kind of briefly going and giving an overview where we started. Today we're going to touch a little bit about the obligation or otherwise maybe a person has or has not the chiyuv to spend money, their own money, to save a life. If so, how much money does a person have to spend? If a person spends money, for example, for the rescue mission that turns out to be unnecessary or otherwise, how much and to what extent can you bill the person whose life you saved? And eventually, of course, we're going to get to, not today, but we are going to hopefully in the third part of this, how much does a person have to endanger themselves at all, if at all, to save somebody else who is in danger? What are the statistics that you have to be satisfied with, and in what situation are you exempt? Okay, so we started with this last week, just to briefly run through. We started with the Gemara Masechet Sanhedrin, folio 73a, Ayin Gimel Omid Aleph, where the obligation tells us, based on the pasuk L'samod al damrei echa, that source number one. We're going to pick up today from source number six, but just briefly zipping through source number one, which is basically we must attempt to save another person's life. That's what the Gemara says. Minayin l'ro'es chaver shehu tovea benar, or other examples. How do we know that you're chayev la'atzilo? How do we know that you have an obligation? So the Gemara is assuming that you have that obligation. It's not just questioning whether or not you have that obligation. You do have that obligation. What's the biblical source? L'samod al damrei echa. You cannot stand aside when your fellow's blood is being shed. Then we understood that with every mitzvah, there's a value to that mitzvah. What's the reason that we have the underlying Jewish value of that particular mitzvah? And I mentioned that there's something called the Sefer HaMitzvos and Sefer HaChinuch, and by extension, the Minchas Chinuch, which explains the mitzvahs in a very deep way. And the source of why this, the meta value that we're focusing our attention on, L'samod al damrei echa, is a Gemara in Sanhedrin. This was source number two, folio 37a, Lamed Zayin Amud Aleph, where we see that this is the idea of where one person is like an entire world. So if you do not save another person's life, you've destroyed a life, you've destroyed an entire world. And similarly, V'chol makayim nefesh achas ma'ala l'vakosu kilu kiyem l'mole. And likewise, a person who preserves, saves one life is as if a person has saved and preserved an entire world. This is an important principle. This is the principle that really is the behind the scenes version of why the L'samod al damrei echa is in fact this value, which is why this is why we take it so seriously. Source number three is Rabbi Dr. Akiva Tatz, and it's very important too, if you haven't seen this, but to look at source number three, an excerpt from Dangerous Disease and Dangerous Therapy in Jewish Medical Ethics, a very important book. I think it's an important book anytime, but certainly now, that even where the risk to life is small or unclear, even where there is no guarantee that the life at risk will be saved, even where the life to be saved is of low quality or the life to be saved is expected to be of short duration. And all of these are very important points that he makes and expounds on. We discussed this a little bit last week as well. Source number four was where we drilled a little bit deeper, where we saw that the pasuk says, L'samod al damrei echa, and this is going to be very important as a jump off point for us as well now today, and our extension of the class that we started last week, which is the Gemara says, one second, you say that that's your verse, that you cannot stand idly. Here we have a second biblical verse that seems to be a second source. Now we know that anytime there's a source that's needed to be explained by the Gemara, okay, that's the purpose of the Gemara, that's what the Gemara does. But anytime there's a second source that seems to be teaching the same thing, so then we have to understand, why does the Gemara present a second source? Why would the Torah give us two sources of the same thing? And that's what the Gemara does in the source number four, is it's not that it's only one source, L'samod al damrei echa, L'samod al damrei echa, but I'll tell you, there's another source. The pasuk from Parshas Ki Tse, where the pasuk says, V'hashevo so lo, the obligation that we have to fulfill the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda, to return a lost article, lost item. Somebody has lost something, a cheftza. So the Gemara learns by extension that if you're going to save somebody's life, if you're going to save somebody's article, Kal v'chomer ben benoshel, Kal v'chomer halachas kama v'kama, how much more so? Obviously, you should be willing to and jump at, you know, the possibility of saving somebody's life. So then, if that's true, then I have now two sources. V'hashev osalo. Not only do you have to save, return somebody's lost item to them, but if their life is seemingly lost to them, you have to do anything you can to help save their life. So then that's your pasuk. So what do you do with the pasuk lo samar al damrei echa? So the Gemara says, I'll tell you what it means. It means that you might have thought that if the pasuk that tells me that I have to return a lost article, that's my source, which it is the source. But if that was my only source, then I would think that only if the article comes into my domain do I have an obligation to return it. Or in the case of medical recovery, only if I have the wherewithal, only if I know how to save a person's life, if I know CPR or life-saving measures, only then do I have an obligation. But I don't have an obligation if I don't know how to do it. Talmud Lomar, the Gemara says, no, you need lo saman adam re'echa to teach us that even in a situation where you cannot do it, you don't personally have the skills to do it. You have to do something, anything to make sure that that person's life is saved. So if that means you have to hire somebody, you have to make a phone call to help get some help to the scene, you got to do whatever you can. So it's not just that you have an obligation to do it, but you have an obligation to do it even when you think that you cannot do it. That's what lo samod al dam re'echa comes to include, that even your obligation is to hire somebody. The obligation is derived from this pasuk of lost property. And of course, if the person is obligated to prevent another person from losing his property, it stands to reason, kal v'chomer, that he is certainly obligated, his mechliv, to ensure that he won't lose his life. So we see again, lo samar al dam re'echa, that you cannot stand aside idly while your fellow's blood is being shed. So this extra instruction teaches us that a person is obligated, is mechliyev, is required to make an effort and go out of his way to do so, including hiring others to save a life. We discussed, we're not going to get into this now, but I know this was a very rigorous and a lively part of the conversation, is what the comparison between saving a life and Hashavas Aveda really is. And there are a lot of different commentaries in the Achronim and the later commentaries about what the connection is between saving a person's life and Hashavas Aveda. And I shared with you the Chachma Shlomo and the Rav Shlomo Kluger and his commentary on Shulchan Aruch and Rav Moshe Feinstein's famous commentary on that as well. But what we're going to pick up today is we're going to discuss the idea of hiring somebody and the extension of what it means to hire somebody, what it means to get help, that you yourself cannot do something and you have an obligation because of the extended because of that obligation, you have to now call for help and you have to get help. Now we're going to focus our attention today is like what happens when you call for help and there's costs involved. Who has to pay for it? How much do you have to pay? What if you don't have the money to pay for it? What if the person who is, their life is saved, they don't have the money to repay you back and you know that, or let's say you then find it out, somebody else responsible, or let's say you knew it beforehand, would you have had an obligation to save that person to begin with? Or if that person doesn't make it, are you able to draw money from the Yorshim? Are you able to take the funds from the inheritors of the money that the person who passed away passed that money along to in that process? So that's what we're going to focus our attention on today. But just one final source, which was part of the introduction last week, and we're going to jump off from here, is if you look at source number 6, and this is from the Rambam in the Laws of Murder and Saving Life in the first chapter and in the 14th halacha. And this is very important because this is codified in Shulchan Aruch and Choshen Mishpat, chapter 426:1, where we see that there's a similarity in the, and as is usual and as common, this common, the commonality of where the Shulchan Aruch, the Mechaber of Yosef Karo, and the Rambam Maimonides codify in similarity. But here's what's interesting: the Gemara, if you look at the Gemara in source number 1, so the Gemara gives examples of when you see somebody who's drowning, or that person is being dragged by a wild animal, or being treated, you know, threatened by robbers. So how do we know that the obligation is to save that person? But here's what's interesting: is that the Rambam, and as well the Shulchan Aruch, but let's just focus on the Rambam in source number 6, and the laws of murder and the laws of saving life, actually adds to the list. And this is where we're going to see that by extension, a person could say that, Rabbi, the coronavirus, for example, is not added in the list in the Gemara. Obviously, there's a certain license that when we talk about any situation where a person's life is in peril, person's life is in danger, or even if it's a doubt, a possibility, as we mentioned, there are 4 different categories that a person can engage, for example, even on Shabbos and on Yom Tov, a medicine or medical help, even in the situation of a person is a chole, she'ein bo sakana, that means that the person is ill, but it's not it's not that we're not sure that they're in danger. We know, for example, if it's Ein Bo Sakana, that they're not in danger, but even a situation, if it's Suffolk, that they're not in danger. So then, of course, we can go ahead and we can extrapolate the needs that we have to provide for the person who's ill. We can call for help. We can provide medication, so on and so forth. But if you look at the list here of the Rambam, I have the English translation as well. Unfortunately, just for this one, not the others. I'll translate the other ones myself. But if you look at source number 6, the Rambam adds to the list of the Gemara, which again is the license that we have to be able to include other things as well. So look at the Rambam. I'll read the Hebrew and translate as well. So he says, Yudalit, Kol hayachal hatzil velo hitzil. A person who has the ability to save somebody velo hitzil, but does not do that, over is over, is in violation of lo samo da aldamet re'echa, pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim, Perek Yutes Tezayin, chapter 19, verse 16. And here he gives the other examples. V'chein aroes chavero tovea bayam, o listin baim olav, again, these are the ones that the Gemara gives. If you see that his dead person is drowning at sea, he's being attacked by robbers or wild animals, and you can save him, you have a chance to save him. Himself, either he can save him or he can hire somebody else to save him, and he doesn't. And here are the other examples that are in these parentheses. Shama oivde kachavim omosim mechashvim alav ra'ah. Or let's say you hear that an idolater or a Muslim, a person is going to tattletale, that person is going to do ra, evil for you. You don't try to save your friend. You know that you have the ability, if let's just say you know somebody is in harm's way, somebody's planning on attacking and hurting somebody, and you don't have the ability, or you can tell the person who's the attacker not to do that, to be mefaisim, which means to pacify him, to convince him to do something else, and you don't. So like, let's say you know somebody is going to be in the proximity of somebody, let's say, God forbid, you knew a case of somebody who was COVID-19 positive, and they were going to go on a plane. And they were going to maybe possibly expose hundreds of people to their virus. So you have to do whatever you can to the mefais, that person, to try to convince that person not to do it. But a person chooses not to. Last part of this Rambam. And for examples similar to this, if you did not do this, or you stayed quiet, or you were complacent and did not act, over, you are over the law, you're over the prohibition of standing idly when a person's blood is being spilled. That means that even if it is that it doesn't happen, and that means even if it is that you can't do it, if it means that you have to hire somebody else to do it, you have an obligation to do it. And if you don't do it, you're in violation of lo samar adam re'echa. This is very powerful because it is not in our right or purview to assess the situation, to determine whether or not something is dangerous or not. If there's a possibility in this case of it being dangerous, then we have an obligation. If we believe in the meta value principle in the Gemara's quoting in source number 2 about on folio 37a, about this is a value that we believe in, one life, just one life is valuable, and there's a possibility of it being dangerous to anybody, that changes the rules. That makes it that we have an obligation not only to act in accordance to the way we have to act, but also to save other people who are in the possible proximity of others who are acting want derelict, violating the basic health responsibilities that everybody has to follow. So this is what the Rambam codifies in Halacha. And here's an interesting addition here, the concept of Ovde kochavim or mosrim. If somebody is going to be a moser, who's a moser? You know, that the idea of conspiring to harm his colleague, planning to snare a snare for him. If you know somebody is going to just tattletale. Now, we have to be very conscientious. Obviously, there's a lot of gray in that concept of what a moser is. You know, there's a lot of rhetoric around the time when, you know, we sent letters out. All the rabbis sent a letter pre-Pesach when there were going to be people traveling from certain hotspot areas up north, and if in fact they were going to violate the call of the local law enforcement and medical directions, and they were going to come anyway. So of course, as many of you remember, there was a letter that was sent by the rabbis that we will report you. So many people called and said, how could a rabbi decide that they're going to report somebody to the authorities, so that this is no longer allowed? This is something that clearly is a category of Mosrim. So that obviously needed das of the wisdom of, and the psak of Gedol and Big Rabbanim who paskin, that there are situations, usual cases of Mosrim, of course, that's not allowed. But when there's a possibility of death and a possibility where people could be in significant harm's way. So then you have a chiyuv, you have an obligation. It's not that dissimilar. Obviously, there's major distinctions, but it's not that dissimilar from situations where, generally speaking, the rule is we're not allowed to speak lashon hara. You're not allowed to speak ill about another person. But there are situations where speaking lashon hara is allowed. If you know that a person's life is in danger, or there's a possibility, let's just say a boy and a girl are going to get together, going to marry each other, but you know that there's certain things that they need to know about before that happens. So then, obviously, then certain laws of lashon hara, it's not that they're suspended, but they're changed to allow that situation to happen. So that's just an interesting observation. Okay, so that's where we pick up. That's the Rambam. I'm going to pick up here from source number 7. But before we do that, any questions, comments, and concerns? Yes, Mark, you have to unmute yourself.
What occurred to me when I was going through with you the Shulchan Aruch, the Rambam, and so on. The question that occurred to me, there are a couple questions. First of all, what do you do in case of triage? And I'm not even talking about, let's say, an emergency room, but you know, that has to do with it as well. Or a situation, let's say you're at the beach and you see two people being really in trouble. One, an older person, one, a young child. Do you apply things like in Mavir and Al Mitzvos, or how do you determine kind of thing?
We're
the first person you come across that's in trouble, or, you know, even on the battlefield when you do triage.
Right. We're going to address some of that in response to Dr. Seinfeld's question at the end of last week's class, which is, at what point do you have to put yourself in harm's way? Like, what happens if you just don't know how to swim, or let's say even if you're going to go into choppy, dangerous waters and your life is going to be at risk. But also the idea of where you have multiple people to save and you only have one ability to save that person. What then, and how do you make that awful choice that you have to do? That's in the amphitheater of war. That's certainly in the amphitheater of medicine and practicing in such a capacity, in such situations that just happen to fall upon such a person in such a situation. We're going to get to that. Okay.
And also the distinction between a Jew and a non-Jew. Let's say you're at the beach again, and there's a Jewish person you know who's drowning, and then there's a Gentile you know who's drowning. Yeah. How do you make those decisions?
Right. That's actually also going to exist in the latter section. Yeah. I could tell you that there was just a discussion among the Rabbonim. There was a case, unfortunately, maybe you heard about it not too long ago, in an area a little bit north of where we are, where there was a situation of a non-Jewish child who had a fatality on Shabbos. And the question was, what and to what extent could people go and save that child in that situation? And there was another child that was there who was also in such a predicament. Now, unfortunately, the child, they tried to save the child, obviously. They couldn't save the child, sadly. But that was a little bit hotly debated among the inner circles of the Rabbanim, and also just the Hatzalah members who were involved in that. But we're gonna get to that. Yeah. Let's focus, if we can, now on the idea of how much money you have to spend, if however much money you have to spend. Let's see. So we see that, we learned already now what's been seen, that a person has to expend effort to save a life. That we know. The question is, must a person also spend money? And if the answer is yes, then how much? Must a person sell his house to pay for somebody else's life-saving operation? Like, how far do you have to go? So imagine like a case, let's just say, I don't know, make up some type of case. Well, let's just say you're hiking with a number of people, and somebody unfortunately loses their footing, and that person falls very far down. You call that person and they don't respond. You can't reach that person. You don't even have the wherewithal to reach that person. Obviously, if you had the skills to do it, that's different. But let's say a situation where you do not have the skills and you're able to call for help, and they're able to bring a rescue mission, and they're able to bring a helicopter to medevac that patient, save the patient's life, saves the person. The hike goes on. A few weeks later, then the bill, I don't know, several thousand dollars for the helicopter flight appears on the person who made the call. So the question is, who's obligated to pay? Is the person who makes the call, who had to swipe his own credit card to make it happen? You're not going to go down to that guy's wallet and get the credit card and swipe it. If you could get to the guy, you'd try to save his life. Or is the person who, right, the accident happened, the accident victim, that person should pay the bill. So who's obligated? The person who makes the call and therefore puts it on his credit card. It was the one who initiates the charge. Or is it the person who's the victim? So it's actually, it seems to some actually that it should be fairly clear cut, the person whose life was saved. I mean, if it wasn't for the fact that the, you know, the person made the call and initiated the, you know, the help and rescue mission that saved his life, then he would not have made it possibly. So obviously you would think that he would be willing to do it. But here's a discussion among the commentaries, in fact, who's obligated and how much are they obligated and why would they be obligated and what happens in situations where they don't have the resources. So let's understand where the case is strong, actually, believe it or not, on both sides. But let's go through source number 7 first and foremost. Okay, so the Gemara says that there is actually a special exemption from payment for damages caused during a rescue mission. Now, you'd be surprised maybe to learn that there have been so many cases over the years where there was such a situation where somebody initiated a cost and the person whose life was saved, and even if it wasn't their life was saved, maybe their life wasn't absolutely in danger, but they were in some perilous medical situation. They said, you know, it's like when the situation is over, maybe it wasn't as severe. While it was happening, it was very severe. So now the person contemplates the severity of the situation, says, you know, maybe it wasn't, maybe you went a little bit too far. Maybe it wasn't necessary. So you have an obligation to pay. Maybe I'll split it with you. So the Gemara says, no. V'rodef shahay rodef acharodef latzilo. A pursuer, that's the rodef, chasing after an assailant. And the purpose why he, for reason why he's doing it is in order to save the victim. So v'shiber esakelim bein shel rodef bein shel nirdaf bein shel kol adam potter. So it doesn't matter whether they, you know, the items that broke, let's say the kelim, the vessels that he broke in the process. He was running to save this person. So whether they belong to the attacker or whether they belong to the nirdaf, they belong to the victim or to the attacker. It doesn't matter. The din is that they're potter. V'lomina din she'im yata oimer kein. Nimsa ein lecha kol adam shematzel es chavero miyad haroidev. You know why the Gemara says this is essential? Because this is not based on strict legal principles of damages, actually. Because we know that in the sugya of Ababa Machteres, which I know Charlie has learned with the early Gemara, the Gemara Shir, finished that a while back, is that we know in many other situations as well. If let's just say you strike somebody's property, you break somebody's property, even actually cases where let's just say you're sleeping, and you extend your arms while you're sleeping and you break a person's vase, you break a, you know, a picture frame. So you're obligated to pay, certainly in situations that are not where a person is sleeping, a person's awake, and accidentally or incidentally, you break, have an obligation to pay. And even in a situation where there's some situation of attacker or victim. So for example, in the case of Baba Machteret, so Charlie, if you remember that, in the case where the person is coming into, you know, your domain, let's say you have an attacker that's coming and he's coming to wound you, and that person's attempt is to mortally wound you, so you are able to strike the first bullet. You're able to assail that, to kill that person first before they kill you, because your life is valuable, like his life is valuable. What's the distinction, though? The distinction is if he turns his back and he's starting to head out the door, then if you kill him, then you're obligated, then you're mechuyev. And what's the side sugya that's related to that case is that in a case where he comes in and he breaks the window or he breaks some pottery, breaks the kalim, who has to pay for it? So generally we say that the person who breaks it has an obligation to pay. So that's what he says. Velomina dinhu. It doesn't mean that this is like the strict legal principle of damages. The case of nezikin, of damages, obligates the person who ruins, wrecks, breaks the property to pay for it. But this is a special ptur, the special exemption. Why? As we said, because nimtz, if it would come out, ein lecha kol adam shematzel schaveru miyad rodef. You know why? Because if we did not rule this way, what happened is no one would save his friend from an attacker. Because if a person's going to have to now make a hocheshbin, well, how much money I have to spend, how much money I have, am I going to be able to retrieve the money back? Certainly in situations where there's thousands of dollars being, you know, would be spent. So people would think twice before saving someone if they knew that they would have to be charged for damages caused during their rescue efforts. It's very simple. That's what the Gemara says. Now the question then becomes is, does this also apply to the rescuer's expenses during, you know, doing the actual rescue? You know, so let's see, if you look at source number 8, the Yad Ramah, it's not Ramosha Isolis, but the Yad Ramah, his commentary in the Gemara says, Mistabra. Mistabrolon de hechon de torach the ogar agore the atzle shokel mine, which means it makes sense, he says, that that where one went to the trouble of hiring, the Ogre Agure is hiring like shluchim, workers, in attempts to save a life. So it makes sense, shokel mine, it makes sense that he can reclaim the money from the person he saved. Why? The ad kan lo chiyove, the chiyove rachmana el mitrach bladure basa agire, which means that the Ribbono Shel Olam only commanded him to go through the effort of hiring people, not to pay for the rescue, which means that is what we saw in the last class that we learned together. Lo samar al damir echa, as an extension of Ahatzilolo, is that there's an obligation to hire somebody, but the obligation does not extend that there's an obligation to pay for the rescue. Mi ima hasam hani mili benafshe, ava mitrach omega agor lo, kamash malon, and that's what we understood. That lo samar adamri echa. This is a quote from the last Gemara that we learned. That the Gemara understands that the second verse lo samar adamri echa teaches you have to go to the trouble of hiring somebody, but it does not say that you have to save that person. Lo kamash malon. That does not mean that you have an obligation to spend your own money. So this is a very important principle here. That's what the Yad Ramo says. So when we question, does this also apply to the rescuer's expenses doing the actual rescue? Or during the actual rescue, the answer is the Yad Ramos says that no. And we know that this is based on a pasuk that tells us Vatsilolo, that's one obligation. Lo samar adam riecha is the second obligation, which obligates you to hire somebody. But hiring somebody is only how far you have to go and no more. You do not have to actually pay. You have to lay it out, maybe. That's what we see as an example, maybe is the first response to the example of the case that I shared with you, that the assumption of the Gemara is Verodev, Shayarodev, Acharodev, Latsilo, Vishibra, Sakalim, makes no difference who the Kalim belong to. It's Pater, Velominad, and even though it's not the legal strict principle, why? Because we're scared that no one's going to save somebody else. So that we understand is somebody has to pay, but who has to pay? So we believe that it doesn't have to be the person that laid it out, because if we would obligate somebody to lay it out, then that person might, like, more likely than not, choose not to do it. It's a perfect stranger. It's one thing to even help save another person's life. We need the Gemara to tell us that Chayiv Latzilo. Meaning, if it wasn't for that obligation, maybe people would, as we see that the concept of the bystander effect is that so many scores of people tend to generally just watch what's happening. They don't necessarily even react to what's happening. So we need a posik or psukim to remind us that we have an obligation because of the principle of one life is so valuable. So if I added to that, I tacked on an additional obligation, which is I have to pay for it. It's bad enough that I have to lay it out. Some people are going to say, I'm not laying that money out. I have no idea if I'm going to get that money back. So if I have to lay it out, that might be an obligation, which we see that's the assumption of source number 7, is that since I see that the Gemara says that I'm not obligated to pay for the damages, the assumption is that you're running and you're attacking, you're trying to save the either attacker, in the case of this person's illness, you're trying to save this person's life. So you don't have an obligation to hold the expense completely and to pay for it. So you lay it out, that's one thing, but to pay for it ultimately, that's not. So that's what the Yad Ramo says. And we learned that from the Gemara that we learned last time. So on the one hand, according to the Yad Ramo, the rescuer can reclaim his expenses from the person who saved. On the other hand, he has to seemingly put up the money during the rescue effort. So now what does that mean? So that seems to be that in the case I gave you, let's say you have the case of the hiker falls. So the case, it was right that the person who swiped his credit card to bring the helicopter, the medevac, to be able to save this person's life. So it was the right thing to do. It was actually the obligation that he had to do. Meaning it would be part of his chiyuv to bring personnel who have the ability to save this person's life, but he's absolved ultimately of the responsibility of the cost of the rescue mission. Now, according to the Yad Ramo's reasoning, the expense will apparently fall on the person whose life was saved, meaning the victim himself. So that's principle number 2. Principle here, number 3, is what about a case of a destitute accident victim, right? That does not have the funds to finance, rescue workers. Are those present, still obligated to save him? Maybe there's a patur. I mean, we're going to learn that there are situations where there are exemptions. When we'll see, we'll get to this next time. But when there are situations where a person has put themselves where their own life is in danger, and it's obvious that their life is in danger and possibly even at risk, there are situations where there's exemptions, where there's a patur. So the question is, if let's just say you're going to expend, finances, money, monetary, a value to the rescue mission, and you're not sure because you know that the person is destitute. The victim, that's the accident victim, is not able to pay back. They don't have the funds. So are those present still obligated to save him? So look at source number 9. This is addressed by the Rush, also on his commentary. This is why we learn the Rishonim. The Rishonim, when you learn the Gemara, Rashi, Tosfos, the Rush, the Rambam, the way we understand the commentaries is this is how they learn the Gemara. This is, it's very similar to like Chumash and Rashi or Tershi B'Chsav and Tershi B'Al Peh. There's a limit to how much we can actually learn without the totality of the commentary, because Chumash without Rashi is not really understanding what Chumash is saying. And to have Chumash without the Gemara is also not to understand the principles. For example, Lo Tvashel Gediba Chalev Imo, you should not cook a kid in its mother's milk. We would have no idea what that means, the three times that it's mentioned in Chumash without the Gemara Maseches Chulin telling us the different parts of Kashrus and the Dinim that follow. That's just one parenthetical example. So here we see that the Gemara says here, which we need to understand, the Rush in his commentary on this Gemara and Daf Ayin Gimel, he explains if the victim has money, so the rescuer can claim compensation. And this, unfortunately, is, again, as I mentioned, this, there's so many cases in Beis Din and Bati Dinim who have dealt with cases where there had to be, you know, claims that were, you know, that were petitioned to reclaim money because the victim whose life was saved, they weren't willing to do it. They claimed that the money spent was excessive, so on and so forth. You can use your imagination. So the Rush explains, Vanitzel, the one who is saved, right? That's the Nitzel, Chayiv Lifroyel Lamatzel, Mashahotzi. That means that he has an obligation to compensate the person who saves him. It's an obligation. That's what the Rush says. And many Bati Dinim use this Rush as part of the authoritative ruling in such a situation. Meaning, De'ein Adam Mechuyav Lahatzel Nefesh Chaveiro Bimamono. A person is not obligated to save his friend using his own funds, where the Eislei Mimono Lenitzel, and these are very important words, because these last five words, Hecha the Eislei Mimono Lenitzel, are going to be very important to try to interpret what the Rush really means. Meaning the first part of his statement is De'ein Adam Mechuyav Lahatzel Nefesh Chaveiro B'Mamono. That if it was just a period there, then we'd be fine. That would mean that a person is not obligated to save his friend from by using his own money. But here's what's interesting. Hecha De'islei Mamona Lenitzel, where the rescued person has money. Now, what does that mean where he has money? Which is the under, what's mashma from the Rush, if we're sitting in yeshiva and we're like, you know, using our thumbs to kind of get into it a little bit more, is it what's mashma from the Rush is that the obligation, it falls on the person whose life was saved. And therefore, the person who saves his life, he doesn't have an obligation to save his friend using his own money. So he can chayev lifra l'matzal mashahotzi. He can retrieve and be compensated for what he used to save this person's life. But here's these last five words. How do you interpret these last five words? And there's a lot of commentary on these last five words. The eislei mamona lenitzel. It's true, you can get compensation from the person whose life you saved, assuming that there's money to get. Now, what if there is no money to get? Now, does anybody and everybody have something to get? Can you take a lien on that person's house? Can you take their car? Can you, I don't know, you garnish their wages from their place of employment? Is it, what does it mean they don't have money? If they're really destitute, does that mean you don't have to save that person? Or if they're really destitute, you still have to save them. And maybe the obligation is on the kehillas, on the Beis Din. Maybe the obligation we're going to see, according to some, is actually on the person. And that means that even if it's a situation where you have to save somebody's life using your own money, you might have to. That's not the general norm, but there might be a circumstance that requires that. So that we gain from these just last five words of the Rush, Hecha De'islei Mamona Lenitzel. The Rush's formulation here, where the rescued person has money, those five words, it implies that a rescue party must have someone in danger, even that a rescue has to save someone in danger, I should say, even if that person doesn't have money. That's the conclusion of understanding what the Rush means. Now, that doesn't mean a person would be reticent, wouldn't be reticent, probably would be. Now, that also doesn't mean you're going to do a whole interview with Drisha V'Chakira to see, hey, by the way, you're laying down there with broken bones. Before I save you and before I spend my money, I'm just curious, what's your bank account like? Like, do you have any savings? Are you going to be able to pay, recompensate me? So the answer is obviously you don't do that. And what we understand is where the rescued person has money, that statement, the Islam Mamona Lenitzel, it means that even in a situation where somebody is in danger, you have an obligation, the rescue party has an obligation to save that person, even if that person doesn't have money. That doesn't mean that we're not going to deploy certain processes to try to retrieve that money. The money is recovered where it can be recovered. Where it cannot be recovered, the rescuer must spend his own money. That's what Rav Asher Weiss writes in Minchas Asher, and he contends that the Yad Ramah would not dispute this ruling, and that even though that's not what we learned as it relates to the Gemara, the obligation is limited to just only hiring workers, and you don't have to spend your own money. That's only the situation where you can retrieve the money. If you can retrieve the money, then good. Now, the problem is in this area of gray, and Sid, you could weigh in on this as well, just from a legal point of view, what a person would claim that they don't have the money for, right? So a person could say, I don't have the money. You have the money. Like, who makes the determination as to whether or not a person has the money? You have that in your savings. You're trying to save that for a rainy day. You want to send your kids to college. You want to be able to, buy another property, whatever it is. But you would say that I don't really want to use that money. Is it that you have to be at zero to say that you have no money? And therefore, Rav Asher Weiss understands the Yad Ramah to mean that if a person, even they don't have money, you have an obligation to save that person. Or does it mean that we try to do anything we can to get that person who saved that victim their money back? And the answer to that is that we do. We try because we're worried that if we didn't, and if it became clear to people that there was a possibility that some dubious type of person, some wildcrat character would try to claim that they don't have the money or they don't want to use that money, which unfortunately has happened so many times, so people would be, of course, less willing to, less interested in even going to begin with in this whole process. I mean, I know again, this is getting into a different area a little bit, but I know a doctor, for example, who was on an airplane, and they called over the intercom in mid-flight that there was somebody who was in medical distress, and they asked for medical help. And when this doctor, who was very close to me, actually went over and helped this patient who needed medical attention, was able to revive this person, had to start an IV, did a few things that were necessary to bring this person back to themselves. So everything was fine until they got a bill. There was a bill, there was a lawsuit, it turned into like a whole big tadram. It was a very unfortunate situation. All this doctor would tell you now, if he spoke to him, I'd put him on the line right now, is he will never, ever reveal that he's a doctor on an aircraft because he felt that he was unprotected. I know that there are laws about that as well, Good Samaritan laws and things of that sort. But again, of course, that's every case is unique to itself. Now, the Ramah, again, before we open up to some more questions here, I'm sure there are some. So that's this interesting formulation of just the Rosh's commentary on the Gemara. And what's amazing about this is you can have just in like three or four lines, you can have the obligation, like who's obligated, the person who saved the victim is not obligated to spend his own money. And then just by five words at the end of this tshuva, at the end of this response, you can say, oh, but that doesn't mean that there isn't ever an exemption. There is an exemption. But the exemption is very unique. It's very unique to a very specific case that has to be evaluated by people. Just because a person applies for an abatement or some type of dues reduction, that doesn't mean that they're deserving of that. Obviously, there's principles that have to be applied. In this case, we're worried about people not saving other people's lives. And so therefore, we would try anything in our power to retrieve money for the person who's the rescuer, because otherwise people would choose not to do that. Where it's at zero, person has no ability, they're really, truly, truly aniyim, they're really destitute, so then that person would have that obligation. That's what Rav Asher Weiss writes in Minchas Asher. That's what he understands the Yad Ramah to mean as well. Now, the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, in his commentary on the gloss in Shulchan Aruch, in the laws of Pidgin Shvuyim. What's Pidgin Shvuyim? Pidgin Shvuyim is redeeming captives. So he cites the Rosh's principle. If you look at source number 10. So this is the Ramah in Shulchan Aruch Yerideya, and the idea of Pidgin Shvuyim, where redeemed captives must compensate their redeemers. He says, Hapode chaveiro min ha-shivya chayv l'shalim lo im islay l'shalim. He has to, right? So one, you see that one redeems, when one redeems his friend from captivity, the one who was redeemed has to compensate him again. Again, same words, im islay l'shalim, if he has what to redeem it, to pay him back with. You got to believe that there's some moral compass of the person whose life is saved, that they're going to be willing to compensate that person in spades. That's normal people. But people, unfortunately, don't always do that. And these words that are quoted here in the Ramah are the words that are really seemingly almost identical to the words of the Rosh. And therefore, we see that he's obligated to pay him, but he's only obligated to pay him if there's money to pay. Now, the Shulchan Aruch HaRav adds, based on this ruling of the Rosh and the Ramah, that one is mechuyav, one is required to save a life, even if the victim does not have the ability to compensate for the rescue costs. And now this is the final hammer blow. And this is really where Rav Asher Weiss's comments are really codified here. If you look at source number 11, in the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, and he writes this in the Dinim, the laws of bodily damages, Nezikin, that you're not allowed to hesitate to save the poor person. So this is, look at source number 11. Haroa es chavero Toveya bayam or listem abayim alav, a person who sees his friend. See, if a person is going to be a chutzman yaker, a person will say, "Roz chaveru, that guy's not my chaver, that guy's not my friend." That's not what it means. Everybody, chaverim kol yisrael, we bench birchas achodish, chaverim kol yisrael, and omar amen. Everybody's supposed to be your chaver. You might not like everybody, but there's a very big difference between loving somebody, the obligation of you have to the reach kamocha, and liking somebody. You do not have an obligation to like everybody, but you do have an obligation to love everybody. So that's almost, you know, a general statement. Aroz chaveru means you see somebody as a compatriot, member of Klal Yisrael. Toveya b'yam alistim b'yam alav v'yochel atzilo, and he's able to save him. This again, it's almost a direct quote from the Rambam, also in the Choshen Mishpat. This is the Shulchan Aruch Harav. Hu ba'atzmo, either himself, or liskor achenim latzilo, or he's able to hire other people to do that. Chayev litreach v'liskor ulatzilo. He has an obligation to go out of his way to save him, to hire somebody to save him. V'choyzer v'nifram imenu. And he's able to go back and be compensated by the person who was saved. V'nifram imenu, im yeshlo, if he has it. Now here's where he says it like now, Behejah spelled out. Vim lav, but if he does not have it, if he does not have the money to pay back, lo yimna, you're not allowed to mun him. You're not allowed to, you know, to push him for it. You're not allowed to press him for it because he doesn't have it. It's very strong language here. Vim lav, lo yimna. Vim nimna. And if you either press him for it, or literally the language here is you're not allowed to hold back. Monea means you yourself aren't allowed to hold back, which is if the person doesn't have money and you hold back, so you're in violation, right? That's what it says. Vim lav, doesn't have it. Velo nimna, lo nimna, you're not allowed to hold yourself back. Velo yimna, vim nimna, and if you do hold back from saving this person's life, you are in violation, you transgress, do not stand idly by while your fellow's blood is at stake. So we see that this principle has now extended to another layer here. Is it's not just that if you can do it, that's vashivosalo, you have to hire somebody. But actually also in addition to that, you have to swipe your card, your credit card, and you can retrieve the funds that you've spent. But you can't retrieve this. If there's no funds to retrieve, then you cannot hold back from trying to save this person's life, which means that's how valuable a person's life is. That's how much we cherish a person's life. That means that even in a situation where you have to spend your own money to save another person's life, you have to do that. You have to do that. And this is something that the Shulchan Aruch HaRav spells out very clear. It's understood from the language of the Ramah, source 10. It's, of course, mashma from this Rush, which is where this whole thing started in source number 9. And that's this case where even though the Yad Ramah says that the rescuer can claim his expenses, what happens in a case where they can't pay anything? So the answer is that there's still an obligation that a person has to do it. Now, yes, it's true that there are different social services that might be engaged to, A, number one, ascertain if the person is truly an ani, if that person is truly unable to pay. Just because this person wants to go on vacation or wants to go out for dinner and be able to save for a rainy day for whatever it is, that doesn't mean that that person is exempt. Exemption means that that person really has no money. That's number one. That has to be taken into consideration. Number two is that the obligation might fall if the conclusion was that people would be less likely to save other people's lives if this was the baroque, you know, everybody like felt that this was the final definitive ruling. So then based in or a community would choose to involve themselves because they don't want people to have to feel that otherwise their lives might be in danger. So therefore that's where communities, that's where monies are spent from Mom and Hektish, from based in. It's not the same obligation as the Gemara and Kiddushin describes. Let's just say a case where an obligation for a boy to have circumcision. So the process the Gemara says in Daf Chavtes, the Gemara says on folio 29, if the boy is not, if the little baby is not given bris milah by his father, so then his mother, right, it's a whole discussion, who's obligated to give him bris milah? Is it his mother? Is it based in? Is it himself? Ultimately, at the end of the day, it's himself because the obligation is on his own body. But we see the Gemara says that there's a chiyuv, there's an obligation on based in. The court has an obligation to gemal him, to give him circumcision. That's a chiyuv. This is not the same case where there's a chiyuv on based in. The chiyuv is on the yachid, is on the person. I would have an obligation to spend my own money, and you would have your obligation to spend your own money to save another person's life. Now, if it would be that person would be less probably would be anyway less likely to do it the next time, or even if we just want to preserve a process to ascertain the truthfulness of that person's claim that they have no money. So then a Beis Din, you know, an outside source, a community's determining whether or not their claim is, you know, is correct is certainly something that the poskim advise. So that's just source number 11. It says it very, very clearly in source number 11, the Shulchan Aruch Harav, don't hesitate to save the poor person. And if you do, or you can't hesitate, vimlav, lo yimna, you can't hold back. Vimnimna, and if you do hold back over lav, you're over on the lav, lo samud al dami echa, which of course nobody wants to be. All right, any questions, comments, concerns? I know we just threw out a lot of stuff there. Yes. You have to unmute yourself. Mark, you have to unmute yourself.
The Shulchan Aruch Harav seems to answer some of the questions I had. Lo tamod adam re'echa should be the paramount consideration. I believe, I don't know if the sources talk about it or not, the question of whether you have to, the rescuer has to use his own money or expect compensation or something, is not really addressed to the rescuer. It's addressed to the victim who saved, that he should compensate his rescuer. Because if you address it to the rescuer, you won't have too many rescuers. Right. I mean, I know even with Hatzola, for someone who's sick and so on, many poskim actually exempt them from certain mitzvahs or even Shmira Shabbos, because otherwise they wouldn't rescue people.
Right. Well, that's the rush. The rush, you're saying the language is right. You're saying that the obligation is...
Yeah, the obligation is addressed to the victim, the guy who's rescued, not the rescuer.
Where the Shulchan Aruch Harav addresses the rescuer, that's like, it's almost like a given. It's like, it's understood that you have to swipe your credit card. And not only that, if you hold back making a calculation that the person has nothing, so then you're over the lav. Mm. He's talking to the rescuer. That it's almost like it goes without saying. It's obvious. It's push it.
Yeah.
Right? Yes, dear Sid. You have to unmute.
Okay. So the question of saving a life is sort of the key element of this. But your example of someone falls down and breaks a leg, okay? And you don't think it really involves saving a life. It's just a broken leg. The guy maybe even says to you, I'm okay, don't call the helicopter. I broke my leg. But you're not sure, right? So the question, and this I would think happens all the time, what do you do? Are you still obligated under those conditions to call the helicopter and spend all this money when it may not involve a situation of saving a life?
It's a good question. Actually, I just dealt with it recently with somebody. A person had a medical situation on Shmini Atzeres. They decided that they're not going to get help on the holiday because they felt like by their own determination that their life was not in danger. P.S. They went after Yontif to the hospital. They had to have emergency gallbladder removal surgery. And it turned out, thankfully, their life is saved. They're okay now. They're fine. But in the postscript of this, the person was wondering out loud with me whether it was correct. Like, how do you make that determination? Like, if it doesn't look like or feel like he had some discomfort. He was uncomfortable. And obviously it's a little bit, in many cases, hard to determine, hard to ascertain. Halacha really describes four categories of people, especially on Shabbos and Yantiv. Amichush ba'almo, which literally means there's a headache, this minor discomfort. Achola she'ein bo sakana, that means a person is sick, but they're not in danger. A person who is cholish yesh bo sakana, that goes without saying. And then sakanas nefashos. Now, that long-winded kind of answer just brings us to the conclusion what Rav Moshe Feinstein writes in the Igros Moshe, which is even a broken bone is serious, and that we cannot know what a broken bone means to anybody. So therefore, you have to treat it as a possibility of severe danger. So that's why if a person breaks his bone, breaks a pinky or a toe, and they feel like they can manage or they could do it, they're not obligated to do that. In fact, it would be derelict and irresponsible for them to do that. You have the shoulders of Rav Moshe to rely on that. So where things get a little bit, the problem is that we tend to make determinations of things based on what is our knowledge. We don't know. If you break a bone and it slices through a vein or an artery that's dangerous to a person's life, which a person cannot know, right? I'm sure the doctors would agree with this, is that you have to seek medical attention. And if a physician would tell you that you're okay, or even on the spot, a physician would tell you that you're okay. So I told him he should have called for help and he should have gone to the hospital. That's what he should have done. Not just because of what we found out in the postscript of that, but because of the symptoms as he described them. You know, I didn't see him on Shemitah Atzeres, but he wasn't in shul. But what he described, and I said, if you were to describe it to me then, and as you described it to the family members that you were with, you had an obligation to do that. So sometimes it's not so apparent. It's not so clear. I think it's an interesting extension to even coronavirus. You know, so unfortunately, what people are doing is they're saying something is not dangerous. It's not dangerous for population A. It's not dangerous for population B. Statistics are showing that people are basically doing okay with it, and they're calling it the flu, or some people call it just slightly more, or slightly less. Everyone's like playing like the statistician of what it is, and the answer is we don't know. And when you have a situation where you just don't know, now is there ever a situation where there's no risk? Obviously, there's never a situation where there's no risk, but you know, by and large, if you see something that requires attention, and even though part of what we're all seeing in public locations and stadiums and synagogues is that people are acting very cavalier, mask wearing and social distancing, primarily either one of two categories of people. Either they had it and they have antibodies and they feel like they're no longer at risk, or they're not a risk to others, or they just don't believe it's that dangerous. And what we understand, the most important source of this whole thing is the Gemara on Daf Lamed Zayin on 37a's, which is one person's life. So if one person's life is potentially at risk, so then it's worth changing everything. We have an obligation to change everything. So you're right. There's a difference between a broken bone, but Rav Moshe would argue that a broken bone requires you to get into the car and go to the hospital. And even though you might say, it's all broken bone, like man up a little bit, you know? Answer is, I'm not saying if you stub your toe, or I'm not saying if you like, you know, you have a little tummy ache, or, you know, unfortunately people take everything to the extremes. You know, they have a little bit of antacids, a little bit of, reflux, or whatever it is. They feel like they have to go to the hospital. Obviously, you have to be discerning, use discretion. But if a person had a broken bone, Rav Moshe would send that person to the hospital.
Rabbi, you'll go back to the story of the jelly beans. Right, you have a pot of jelly beans, and one jelly bean is, right. That's number one. Then I got a question actually for David, since David's on the line.
Let me just share that before we do that. Right, that's a very important example for everybody to know. The example is like, would you roll the? Let's say you had a whole container, a bowl full of jelly beans, and that you love jelly beans. You make Ronald Reagan's love of jelly beans look. Diminished, right? You love jelly beans, but there was one that was laced with poison that if you ate it, you would die on the spot. Would you eat any jelly beans? Would you give the jelly beans to your children? Like, obviously the majority of the jelly beans are fine, but there's one that could possibly kill you. Would you take a chance? Would you give it to your children?
I got a question for David. Is there something in a Hippocratic oath or something from a medical standpoint, you see somebody in danger, are you responsible to, as a doctor, to be able to jump in and do whatever you can at that point?
Well, I don't know if it's in the Hippocratic Oath, but the rabbi mentioned these Good Samaritan laws, right, which are very common across the United States to protect doctors. Because it was, you know, the concern is what the rabbi mentioned. You're trying to do the right thing. You see somebody in distress, whether it's on an airplane or there's a car accident, and you go right over and you want to help. And then you don't want to be the subject of malpractice litigation if you do something that's not 100% correct in the eyes of a plaintiff's attorney. So these laws are enacted specifically to protect physicians in that type of a circumstance. Whether it's in the Hippocratic Oath, I don't know. I don't put a lot of stock in the Hippocratic Oath because it starts with these invocations to these pagan gods. So I keep Maimonides' prayer for the physician in my office. But so whether it's in the Hippocratic Oath or not, I think all of us are kind of hardwired to assist anybody who's in distress and do whatever you can in that kind of a circumstance. A lot of physicians were turned off when there were circumstances where they would get sued, you know, like the expression, no good deed goes unpunished. So then you have the scenario that the rabbi described with a physician trying to help someone out on an airplane and all of a sudden is entangled in a whole legal mess. So most states have enacted laws to protect physicians as long as they act in good faith and don't do something egregious.
You just reminded me of something that happened a few years ago in the shul. Somebody needed medical attention and I ran over to help that person. And we were crowded around after the event, after the person was taken care of, everything was fine. And there were a few doctors that were standing around and that were there actually in the scene. And somebody pointed like an accusatory finger to the doctor and said, why'd you let the rabbi jump there to this person? You're a doctor, you should go there. To which the person said that he was like concerned about treating this patient or this person who fell ill. And they're worried about what that would mean on the premises of the shul, if the person's going to leave. So obviously he had bad experiences or had concerns that precluded his involvement, but that was literally his response. And I didn't really interact with him post that, you know, to find out and to uncover like what that was. But I just remember having that encounter, like there was a little bit of hesitancy. And I think you're right though. We tend to gravitate towards helping. We are ones that will stop on the side of the road. We'll try to do whatever we can, even if we have no idea, you know, what it is really that we need to do to assist somebody. But there's a lot of consequences. And the reason why sometimes there are consequences is either there's cases of dine mominis, financial situations, or just malpractice. People think that they were just not handled properly. They weren't handled correctly. Even though, as you just said, no good deed goes unpunished. Unfortunately, that's the case. And therefore, there's hesitancy that happens as a result. We hope that that's not the case. We hope that everyone's going to be there for each other, which is why we have to be careful, conscientious, responsible, trained, do whatever we can. But these are real topics. These are real sugyas. And where they apply in our world today is like just what's ambiguous about something that's molecular, something you can't see, a virus, a contagion, this fatigue that people are feeling. Is it still as dangerous as it was? Is it virus load? What is virus load? I mean, you see all these people that are laymen that are using all these medical terms that they really don't have no idea what it all means. And that's what I think is at the root base core of why people are being cavalier in certain areas, because they've determined in some capacity, either themselves, you know, they have antibodies and therefore they're not at risk and they're not at risk to others. Or there are many people say, you know, somebody said to me, you know, this is being recorded, so I guess it's all out there. It's fine. Said to me, Rabbi, you're on the, in the worry wart camp. You're just, you know, there's a lot of people that are just scared. And I said, I don't think it's being worry wart. I think it's just being cautious. I think it's being responsible. Like I know what I know and I know what I don't know. So I think that there's a sense of being cautious. You have to be responsible. You can rematriculate into the world. But it's not just even about, I mean, it's very simple. It's not just even about you having antibodies or I'm just using it in the current events here. Not just you having antibodies, you being affected by it, but somebody else is affected by it. And even if it is, I mean, how many conversations do we have about low plug or Maris Ayan? Like there's a lot of Maris Ayan issues out there, which is a person will say, I'm not going to wear mass social distance because I had it, therefore I have antibodies. So how does that look? Like you could have 10,000 people are going to go to a wedding, but you could say that every single one of them had antibodies, but how does that look to the world? It looks terrible to the world and it's not right. And so therefore we have to be very strong and vigilant against it. But you see that there's like the clinical case and there's certain applications and there's certain, you know, obviously initial sources, the Gemara, the Rishonim that discuss these cases as they play in and then understanding who's at risk and what is considered a sakana and what do we do and how do we respond? And how do we not only ourselves keep ourselves safe from other people, but what do we do when we see other people that aren't being safe? And therefore Rabbi, the obligation then becomes like, if you see somebody not acting the way they should, you have an obligation to go over to that other person. It's not comfortable for, somebody to go over to somebody else who's not acting the way they should and say, put your mask up above your nose. It's not comfortable, but it's our obligation. I don't think it's like, it's a good Samaritan thing, but it's our obligation to do that per what we're learning here. So anybody who did that, kol hakavod, you got mitzvos. Yes, dear Candy.
Rabbi, I'll give you a recent example of what you're saying. My daughter was skiing when she fell and dislocated her shoulder.
Hey.
Knowing that she had done that, as she's a physician, she couldn't move. A doctor skiing by stopped and she said, I know what's wrong with me. Can you put my shoulder back in place? And he said, oh, yeah, I can do it, but I won't give you my name.
Wow.
And that's how he protected himself and I guess fulfilled the mitzvah, I'm guessing.
Wow. And she was all better right on the spot, continued, hopefully.
She Then she was taken down on a stretcher and went to surgery.
Oy vezmir.
But at least he took her out of pain.
Yeah. So at least he took her out of pain. At least he helped her. But look, yeah, you're right. That highlights the concern that people have. But at least he was able to do it and help her and fix the problem, at least in the most acute way, before she was potentially even more in more danger, right?
True.
Maybe he just didn't want her to send a reward to him afterwards.
Oh.
Perhaps.
Wow. You must be a descendant of Rav Levi Mibarditchev. You are a Varditchever. That is such positive way of thinking. I love that. Just, I don't want to lose my schar. I don't want to lose my reward. Let me just remain anonymous. A lot of people, when they give stuck, are like, let me give you the spelling of my last name so that when you make the plaque, you should put the plaque like nice and big, right? And then there are others who just want to remain anonymous. All right, amazing. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining me.
Bye.